Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And if you would like to join us today on the program, if you have a question about the Bible or Christianity, if you have a difference of opinion from the host on any subject that you've ever heard addressed on this show, feel free to call me in the coming hour. And we have a line open you could take right now if you want to at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. I just have a couple of announcements to make, then I'm going to go to the phones. One of them is that tomorrow, Saturday, at 4 in the afternoon, I have a gathering in Orange County for our Southern California listeners in a town called Lake Forest, which is near Irvine. And I do this not even so frequently as once a month, although we try to aim it once a month, but it gets canceled from time to time. But it's not canceled now. And tomorrow, October 17th, 4 o'clock p.m., we have our open Bible discussion in a home in Orange County, and you're welcome to join us there. That's why we have it. And then there's a meal served afterwards, a dinner, and it's always very good. If you'd like to go to that, by the way, the meal is free, of course, and so is everything else about the meeting. You'll want to call for directions, Don or Jennifer, and their number is area code 949-855-7821. That number again is 949-855-7821. I look forward to seeing our Southern California listeners again tomorrow. And then on this, the next night, Sunday night, we have only in the Santa Cruz area on the radio, I have a new program. It does not preempt the Narrow Path, but it has been added. It's a Sunday night live program directed to non-Christians, and it's called The Road to Find Out, and that's on Sunday night at 7 o'clock Pacific time, and you can hear it on the internet. You can go to our website and get some directions about how to hear that on the internet if you want to, but that's every Sunday night, 7 o'clock, and that's a show that I'm encouraging our Christian listeners not to call in, because I want to talk to people who are not Christians. That's, the Narrow Path, 5 hours a week. I get to talk to people who are Christians or non-Christians, but mostly Christians. But on Sunday nights, I'd like to primarily have conversations with people who are not yet believers. And that's on Sunday nights at 7. Like I said, you can go to the website for directions on how to listen to that online. But it's on, if you live in the Santa Cruz or Salinas or Monterey areas, that's going to be on, that's on KSCO, which is AM 1080 on Sunday nights. Okay, so those are those announcements. And one other, and that is next Wednesday night, the program that I was interviewed for some months ago on the History Channel is going to be playing. It's part of a series of History Channel programs. The series is called The Nostradamus Effect. And the particular episode that for which I was interviewed about the Book of Revelation is called The Secrets, I think it's called The Secret of the Seventh Seal. Sounds very mysterious, of course. And I was one of many people interviewed for that. I know they've told me that I'm on it, but I don't know, if I might only be on it for 30 seconds, for all I know. But anyway, they're going to be playing it on the History Channel Wednesday night. And I've been told that it's at 9 o'clock Pacific time, but you'd need to check if you're in a different time zone, you know, what time it is in your area. All right, so those announcements are, that's Wednesday night, the 21st, and on the History Channel. Let's talk to Tom from Monterey, California. And you know what, I haven't even given the phone number out yet, so let me give that out. Then we'll talk to Tom. If you want to call me here on the air, you can call 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Be glad to hear from you today, Tom. From Monterey, our friend Catholic Tom. Welcome.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you. Hey, I'm glad to hear that you're doing a secular radio program. And
me too. You can pick that up in Monterey.
Oh, yes. And you know what? Somebody called in from Fresno on that same radio station And
really?
They were able to pick up that signal in Fresno. So that signal
goes out
quite a way. So
it's
hopefully it'll
strong,
pick up from all over the place, plus the Internet. So that's super duper. So
yeah,
like
great.
Like I said, hopefully most of the people that are listening to this are saved, and all we have is questions. Those people maybe need to be saved, so that's a good thing. So, although you do get atheists, which we haven't heard too much from our atheist friends lately. So.
Right, but my first Sunday night program last Sunday was about atheism, and I had a guest on with me who is an atheist herself, and we took calls also. And that atheist will be on with me again this Sunday, but we'll still be taking calls.
Yeah. And I heard she did very well. I didn't hear the program, but from what the way you were talking, she sounded like she asked at least posed some good questions.
I liked it. I liked the conversation. I thought it went well. Yeah.
And I tell you, so you know, when I get into that point, it almost becomes, you know, you either have faith or you don't have faith, because it gets to a point where you really can't prove either way, in my opinion. But
well, that's true. You can't prove to another person that God exists.
Right.
And no one can prove that God does not exist. However, you can give people reasons to consider that belief in God is the most reasonable explanation of what we know.
Mm-hmm. That's
you know, right. when we're looking for the reasons and purpose behind what we do know, we often need to look for an inference to the best explanation,
right.
Which is often, I believe that belief in God is that best explanation. But that's what remains to be demonstrated to the satisfaction of a number of people, especially now, because there are so many books coming out by atheists saying that belief in God is just stupid.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? Once a person does accept Jesus' invitation and you start looking, holy smokes, it's almost like it's overwhelming. Every day I see the little things that just touch my life, and I say, you know, there has to be somebody watching over me, because I'm too dumb not to have all these good things happen to me. So anyway, even bad things happen. But if you look at where they're leading you to, it's all for the good.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you're dumb, Tom. I think you're very smart. I just don't know why you're still believing the things you believe.
Good point. Hey, well, let me get to my point, and it's more of a almost a disagreement, almost like why are you treating a Catholic different than you are a Protestant? And here it goes.
Okay.
I called a while back about the you had a caller call in and ask about the verse where I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until I enter into the kingdom. And
yeah.
I went into you had mentioned that it was the Passover and whatnot, and I was trying to show where in the Last Supper that Jesus he keeps on fulfilling the Passover through himself doing the sacrifice and all that, and all the parallels going back into Exodus and whatnot. And then you had a caller up. Well, going back, that was actually this caller was before I even called, because I'm still in the archives every morning trying to catch up to where I am at the present. But you had a caller, Terrence, and I'm not sure where he was calling from, but he
Las
was
Las Vegas. He's from Las Vegas.
All right. Very nice guy. He was calling about how often we take communion. And with him, you seem to follow along what most people would think of communion as, you know, off giving bread and wine or bread and grape juice. And not just a meal, but with my call, you seem to say, well, I take communion every day because it's a spiritual communion, and it is how we live our life every day dedicated to Christ in remembrance of him. But
well, let me clarify something.
Good.
I think you misunderstood what I said to you, because I don't say that I take communion every day, although there is a way of understanding taking communion that I could perhaps agree with that statement, but it's not something that I would normally say because it's not what I normally think. What I did say is that the passage in 1 Corinthians 5, where Paul says, therefore, let us keep the feast, not with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. You had indicated that that's a reference to communion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe it is, but I did say that what Paul is talking about there is something that we do every day. He's talking about our lifestyle, a lifestyle that is not leavened by malice and wickedness, but is characterized by sincerity and truth. Keeping the feast of unleavened bread, in other words, to Paul, is fulfilled in the way we live our life day by day. Now, I did say that, but the difference was you equated that with taking communion. I don't. I don't think Paul's talking about taking communion there.
Okay. Well, what I was trying to get at was when I called about I shall not drink of the fruit of the vine.
Yeah.
I was trying to get into that, the fulfillment theology, which both of us kind of seem to see that in the Gospels. Jesus is fulfilling the old covenant of the Passover with his new Passover that he's giving us to eat the bread and the wine. And if that's true, then it should be taken at least once a year. And if it's not true, well, then I guess we only have to take it once in our entire lifetime, and we're good to go. And I know
it is true.
5 years, and you said, well, I guess that's true because it doesn't say.
Yeah, Jesus doesn't say how often to take it. He said, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you show forth the Lord's death until he comes. He didn't say how often they would. Now, you're right. They were accustomed up to that point in doing it yearly, because that's how the Jews observed the Passover, as a yearly thing. But Jesus was not saying that they would necessarily continue to do it on a yearly basis. He just said as often as you do it. And maybe he thought they'd do it on a yearly basis. I don't know. But we do find in the book of Acts that they met daily for the breaking of bread.
Right.
And many people think that the breaking of bread doesn't just mean to having a meal together, but actually taking, as we would say, communion. So it's possible that they actually took it every day. And I know in the Roman Catholic Church, you can do that too. You can take Mass every day. That doesn't mean that that's something that was ever commanded.
So now in context, though, if Jesus is fulfilling the Passover, and it seems as though I don't know whether all of the apostles and disciples saw that at that time, but it sure seems to be the way John is writing his gospel, just about all the things that I brought up. That you know he's in the garment that the sacrifice would have been done for the high priest. And he dies at 3:00, which is the same time the lambs were slain, and it just goes on and on and on with all these different parallels in there. It seems to me, in context, since Jesus doesn't say, then the old covenant would follow through on those requirements.
I understand. I understand what you're saying. And I certainly agree with you that the crucifixion of Jesus followed in many respects along with the ritual of the Passover that was taking place at the same time. I'm with you on that. Now, where you and I differ on this and on several other similar kinds of points is that I think you assume that since the type, that is, Passover was a type of what Jesus accomplished, since the type was observed as a yearly feast, that therefore the antitype or the fulfillment of the type must represent something that's done on a yearly basis, too. I don't necessarily agree with that. Likewise, you and I would disagree probably on Sabbath, because I'm sure you would think that Sunday was the Sabbath, and I don't. I don't believe there's a Sabbath day that we're commanded to observe in the New Covenant. I believe that the Sabbath was a type of something that's permanent and continuous in our lives as we rest. We enter into God's rest in our lives by not trusting in our own works, but trusting in the finished work of Christ.
But
here's the thing.
Okay,
the type was a weekly observance. Now, you would see the fulfillment of it in Sunday and as a weekly observance. But I don't know that the Bible ever would give any reason to believe that. I think that a ritual that was practiced yearly does not necessarily mean that it represents something that in the future would be observed yearly. Take, for example, the Day of Atonement in Israel. That was an annual thing. Once a year, the high priest went into the Holy of Holies and sprinkled blood on the mercy seat and came back out. That was a yearly thing. However, what it represented was Jesus going into heaven on our behalf, and he hasn't come out yet. So the type was a yearly festival. The antitype is not a yearly thing. It's a permanent thing. And so that's where you and I would see things differently. I agree that the Passover was annual. Jesus and the disciples took the Passover annually before his death. But from that point on, we don't know that they kept it annually. There's no record of it.
Mm-hmm. And I will, which I've never really even looked into the Day of Atonement, but I would agree with that. But in the, again, in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, we see not only, like you said, that they met in their homes and broke bread together, which, like you said, most scholars say that breaking of bread was communion.
Yeah.
And it seems as though the early church fathers write that way. But we also see what you mentioned there in the Sabbath. We see a parallel on that. Jesus gives us the Lord's Day, and they met on the Lord's Day.
Wait. No, it actually doesn't say that in Acts.
Oh, it may not say it in Acts, but it does say it in the New Testament.
Actually, it doesn't. The only time the term the Lord's Day is used in the New Testament is in Revelation chapter 1, where John said he was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. It doesn't tell us he went to church. Of course, he was on a prison colony island in Patmos. But that's the only time that the Lord's Day seems to be used as a technical term in the New Testament in the book of Revelation chapter 1. But,
well, I know somewhere it says they met on the first day.
Yes,
and
it does.
They call it something.
No. In the book of Acts, there is one reference to the church in, I think it was the church in Tyre, if I'm not mistaken. It says they met on the first day of the week. It doesn't say they did it regularly, but Paul was visiting, and it says they gathered together on the first day of the week, which of course would be Sunday, and it says to break bread. And to hear Paul preach, because Paul was leaving the next morning. Now, it's possible to suggest that they met every Sunday and that Paul just joined them for their regular Sunday gathering.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's equally possible that we could just toss a coin on this because we don't have any evidence one way or the other. It's equally possible that that was an unusual meeting because Paul was leaving the next day. They held a special meeting so they could hear him speak. And it happened to be the first day of the week. That's the only place in the Bible that speaks about Christians meeting on the first day of the week. You also have a verse that sometimes is used in 1 Corinthians 16, I think it's verse 2, where Paul is telling the Corinthians to take up a collection to give to the poor Christians in Israel, in Jerusalem. And he tells them on the first day of the week they should lay something aside for the offering to the poor saints. Now, many people have assumed that this meant that they would pass an offering plate at their Sunday service. But that's not what Paul says. Paul just tells every individual to set something aside on the first day of the week. One might argue that what that means is after the Sabbath is passed, the new week begins, and they should begin their week by setting aside something that will be given, sort of first fruits, as it were, so that when Paul would come by, he could pick it up and take it to the poor in Jerusalem. But, you know, those are the only two references in the New Testament to the first day of the week. One is where the church gathered on that occasion before Paul was leaving the next day, and we're told that that meeting occurred on the first day of the week, but we're not told that they ever met on the first day of the week otherwise. And then there's Paul's instruction to them to lay something aside on the first day of the week, but he doesn't indicate that this laying aside will take place at a church meeting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to have to look into that, but that's not really what I called about. I was calling more about the communion as a parallel to the Passover, and that was done once a year. So.
Okay, you're right about that.
All right, God bless. And
but let me ask you this, Tom. Just one question, Tom.
Sure.
But you, as a Roman Catholic, you don't take Eucharist just once a year.
No, I take it every day.
Okay, so what is the connection then? That Passover is taken once a year, and you mentioned that the Eucharist is related to that, right? And so what is your point there as far as, I mean, how is that impacting our duty about keeping the Eucharist?
Well, I'm not quite following you. Other than,
I guess the point I'm making is this: the point you called to make is that since the Passover is the foreshadowing of the Eucharist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was done once a year.
Right.
And Jesus said, as often as you do it in remembrance of me. I thought you were implying that the disciples then would understand that to mean once a year.
And that is what the church teaching is, that you are to take communion at least once a year.
Oh, I see. I got you. Okay, that's what I wanted to know. So
yeah.
You're saying at least once a year. Okay. Okay.
So, and again, it's that remembrance, according to other Greek scholars and Hebrew scholars, which I'm not even close. I can't even read half the words that are in there. But that remembrance was a real-time remembrance. It was not like I remember my loved one. It's like you're actually there reliving that entire event.
Well, I think if the Greek word really necessarily had to mean it that way, that there'd be as many, I mean, there are many Protestant scholars who can read Greek too, and they would see that. I think probably the word could be taken either way, and a Catholic scholar would say, you'll see, it means this way, and Protestant might say it means this other way. I mean, the word remembrance, I'm sure, is a word that had a range of meanings, and people with a particular viewpoint could seize upon whichever meaning.
And that's a possibility, yeah.
They felt supported their view, yeah. Well,
right.
I appreciate that, Tom.
God bless, and I'll be listening to you on Sunday. And you might want to put on some way that we can donate to that program.
Well, you know what?
I'm
not going to.
It's fairly inexpensive, isn't it?
It's about $150 a week.
Wow.
And or a little more than that. I'm paying it out of my own pocket at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't intend to ask for money or have commercials on the program. So. I mean, when I'm talking to unbelievers, I don't even want to mention money.
No way.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I'm not even asking on this program for people to contribute to it. But if they want to, they can. I mean, obviously, those who write to the Narrow Path, if they want to, you know, put a memo on the check, say this is for, you know, the Sunday night broadcast, then I could see it go that way. But I'm not soliciting for that.
Well, if it's coming out of your pocket, then maybe we'll just slip you some money when we see you at the home fellowship. So.
Well, that's between you and God. At this point, I've paid in advance a couple months on that
super
show.
Duper. All right. Well, God bless.
Okay, Tom. God bless you.
Again. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Well, we had another call, but the call didn't stay on, and our lines are open now. So if you'd like to be on. We had a long conversation with Tom, and that may be why the other caller didn't stay. But Tom and I usually ramble on a bit when he calls. He doesn't call all that often anymore. So you can get through now, and if you're the first, you'll get through immediately. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And the phone's ringing again. Now, hey, let me just say, if you've never been to our website, do go to the website. You'll find nothing for sale there, but you'll find many things of value, things that other people would sell you. We just won't sell them to you. We'll give them to you. And there's hundreds of resources like that. And by the feedback I get, my impression is that people find them valuable resources. They are... about 900, I believe, lectures of mine, teaching through the whole Bible verse by verse, as well as teaching quite a large number of different topics. There's other resources there, some printed resources. If you want to donate to the program, you can find there a PayPal link, but you're certainly welcome to have anything that's at the website for free, and you need not feel obligated to donate. The website is thenarrowpath.com, and you should find your way around that, because lots of people have made a home, a sort of a second home for themselves there. Some people have told me they've downloaded every lecture there, all 900 of them or so, and listened to them all, and they're waiting for more to go up. Well, there's more elsewhere. There's even a link at our website to another website where more of my lectures can be found that aren't at my website. Anyway, That's thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk to James from Albany, Oregon next. Hi, James. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, bro. Just a question for you. Hey, in the Christian life here, with all the stressors and you know, derailings and everything that goes on in our life, how would you say it's possible to live a life for Christ with reckless abandon, forsaking all things, as if Jesus was walking down the road and waved at me and you and said, "Hey, James, Steve, come follow me." Is it possible in this life to really live like He wants us to, and not be lukewarm, not be on the fence, but be really on track? I know we're shooting for the mark, and we're fallible humans. But how would you say, bro, your approach is to doing your best and following after Jesus? And I'll take that off the air, okay?
Okay, James. Thanks for your call.
Thanks, man.
Bye now. Well, let me think about that. First of all, I want to say that all people are called to be disciples of Jesus, and a disciple is one who is learning from Him. Why do I know that? Because in the book of Acts, that was the term that was given to the whole church, the disciples. Everyone in the church was called the disciples. Later on, in Acts 11, they also got the name Christian added to them. In fact, it says in Acts 11:26, the disciples were first called Christians at Antioch. So the church, everyone in the church were called disciples before that point. At that point, Acts chapter 11, they also received a secondary label, Christians, but they were still the disciples. And so as a disciple, we must meet the conditions for discipleship. But before I tell you about those conditions, I need to say that not everybody's discipleship looks alike. For example, you mentioned, you know, can we walk down the street as if Jesus is there and we're, you know, just like the disciples of old? Well, if we mean the apostles who left their jobs and left their homes and wandered around just living by faith with Jesus and being taught to preach and being sent out to preach, I think that can be done, but it can only be done if that's what you're called to do. Because not all the disciples were called to be apostles. They weren't all called to be preachers even. We read mostly about the ones that were, because most of His teaching was given to the ones who were traveling with Him and who were able to record what He said. But He certainly had disciples who were not traveling with Him. I mean, Lazarus and his two sisters, Mary and Martha, truly were disciples, but they lived in one place. They didn't follow Him around, as far as we can tell. There must have been many others like that. In fact, there was the man of the tombs, who Jesus cast a legion of demons out of, and the man begged to go with Jesus. And Jesus said, "No, you go back to your home and tell your friends about me." So here, this man was to be a disciple, but he was not to be one who followed Jesus around geographically. Now, when I first entered the ministry and got filled with the Spirit, my desire was to be just like the disciples, actually just like Jesus, and wander around led by God to people to talk about the kingdom of God and to live by faith. And I actually thought that's what everyone should do. I've since come to be more balanced. That was 40 years ago. As I studied the scripture more, I realized that not everyone is called to do that. I think I was, but not everyone is. And it's partly because I was that I kind of felt like everyone was. We do have a tendency to impose on others duties that we feel incumbent on ourselves. And I really have enjoyed that kind of a lifestyle. And I think anyone who's called to it probably could enjoy it, at least until the really persecution comes on strong. Then you just have to endure it. But not everyone is called to wander around and be jobless and, homeless and all of that stuff and just a full-time preacher. But everyone is called to be a follower of Jesus in the sense that we follow His teaching. We come under His teaching, and He gives us instruction for life. Jesus said in John 8:31, "If you continue in My words, then you are My disciples indeed." And we're all supposed to be disciples. He said, "Unless you forsake all you have, you cannot be My disciple." But that sounds almost like everyone who's a disciple must have nothing. But that's not really true. Because forsaking all that you have doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have a job, a home, a family, a car, clothing, etc. It might sound like that, but I know it doesn't. And one reason I know that is because when Jesus told the rich young ruler to forsake everything and follow him, Peter said to Jesus, Lord, we have forsaken everything and followed you. What will we have? Now, it was true. Peter and the others who were with him were examples of people who had forsaken everything. And yet, Peter had a house. Peter had a boat and fishing nets. They still use them sometimes after this. Peter had a family. Peter did leave his job because he was called to be a full-time preacher. But having forsaken everything doesn't mean he didn't have anything. What it meant, I believe, is that whatever he had had now is forsaken in the sense that it is signed over to God. It's signed over to Jesus. And so Peter had a house and a family, but his house became a meeting place for Christians. He had a boat for fishing, but his boat became a pulpit for Jesus to preach from. That is, he didn't really have to sell all his stuff and liquidate it and stand out on the street corner and wait for the next piece of bread to fall from heaven. He literally had stuff that he had. When Peter said, we have forsaken everything, Jesus didn't deny it. They had forsaken it, but they still owned it. How do you work that out? Like this. When we come to Christ, we realize that we are being purchased ourselves by him. We are being bought into slavery. That's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6. We are not our own. We've been bought with a price. Therefore, we are to glorify God with our body and our spirit, which are his. And obviously, if you've been bought into slavery, all the stuff you owned belongs to your master now. You've been purchased. You have forsaken your ownership of all that you have. But because you're a slave, it doesn't mean that you don't have anything in your hands, because the master of slaves entrusts them with his goods to be stewards. And so Peter owned a house until he became a disciple of Jesus. Then Jesus owned his house. I mean, the deed wasn't signed over to Jesus, but in Peter's heart, Jesus owned the house, and Peter was simply the steward of it and of the boat. And that's true of any true disciple. How can we be totally sold out to Jesus? Well, by selling out to Jesus, by saying, okay, nothing I have is mine. God has paid a price for me and for all that is part of my life. And that price was the blood of Jesus. And that's a high price. And the reason I'm a disciple is because I have accepted that transaction. There are people that Jesus paid for, but they don't accept the transaction, and he never gets them. But a Christian is someone who says, I'm not going to cheat God out of what he paid for. He bought me. He owns me. I'm giving myself to him, and all that I have is his. But that doesn't mean I sell my house and my car and my record collection. It might. It depends on whether the record collection is suitable for me to keep or not. But the point is, whatever I have becomes his. And there indeed may be things that I have that he says, no, that's extravagant, or that's immoral, or that's not right, and I do have to get rid of it. And it may be that he'll have me sell some of my stuff and give to the poor, like the rich young ruler is told to do with all his stuff. But Peter didn't have to sell all his stuff and give it to the poor. Each person stewards God's things according to God's own wishes for that person. And so God might want you to keep the house and the car and the guitar and the whatever else you've got, the carpeting and the furniture, because it may be that he has use for it. It may be that your owning it or your stewarding of it is advantageous for the kingdom of God, in which case you shouldn't get rid of it. Remember, there was somebody who owned a donkey, and Peter and John went and started taking the donkey according to Jesus' instructions, and someone said, hey, where are you going with that donkey? It wasn't theirs. But the people who were asking about it, it might have been theirs, I don't know. And the disciples said, the Lord has need of it. And then the owners let it go, because they realized that even though it was their donkey, the Lord needed it. And, of course, he had the prior claim on it. If God needs it, then, of course, it's not mine, it's his. And that's how a true disciple must be. Now, if you're asking me how a person can get the feeling that Jesus is walking next to him and so forth, or the feeling that they are sold out like the early disciples were, I don't know how to manufacture feelings. I've never really considered that true discipleship amounts to a certain kind of feelings. Feelings go up and down and all around, and there's, you know, you don't control your feelings. And therefore, I can't give any instructions about how to have certain feelings. All I can say is you can truly sell out to God. And that's the only way to be a disciple, which means the only way to be a Christian, because a disciple is a Christian. The disciples were first called Christians at Antioch. So if you want to be a Christian, a follower of Jesus, it means that you do business with God in this way. You say, okay, I acknowledge that Jesus paid for me. What's more, God, you created me, so you owe me on two counts. You own me, I should say, on two counts. You own me because you made me, and you own me because you bought me. And therefore, I guess I don't own myself. Therefore, all that I am, all that I have, from this point on, is going to be totally yours. You can do whatever you want with my stuff or with me. And if you want me to sell it, get rid of it, give it to the poor, I'll do that. If you want me to keep it and use it for you, I'll do that too. I'm just the steward. And that's how, I believe, how one becomes a sold-out disciple. They sold out really is a good term for it, because it means you've sold your interest in yourself and in your stuff. Someone has paid a price for it, and that's God, who paid a price, the price of Jesus' blood, which is certainly a high price to pay for what little he got back from me. Anyway, those would be my comments. Certainly much more could be said, but we have other calls waiting. But I appreciate your call, brother. I hope that may help you, James. Let's talk to Jack from Moss Landing, California. Jack, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I'd like to hear your take on the fact that, and normally the gospel presentation is such that a person can't come to heaven because, you know, until the sin issue is dealt with, they have to be cleansed of their sin because God can't stand sin. No sin can be in his presence. If you give me your take on, you know, given that concept, how does God, you know, put up with, if he's everywhere all the time, and we're living in a fallen world and there's this horrible things going on, you know, daily, that it's, you know, my thought is it's got to be horribly grieving for God just to be constantly seeing this stuff, you know. So anyway, if you have some kind of a take or input or scriptures or something that would kind of like shed some light on that, I'll listen on the radio.
Okay, Jack, thanks for your call.
Okay, thanks.
Bye now. Well, when you say, you know, God can't stand evil, and yet he sees it every day, how does he handle that? That's kind of what I understand your question to be, unless I didn't hear correctly. But the idea that God can't stand to see sin is generally an idea that people take from the book of Habakkuk, where the prophet said to God, your eyes are too pure to look upon sin. Which makes it sound like God is too holy, too pure to even see it, to look at it. But I think most scholars would agree that to look upon has the specific meaning of to look favorably upon or to countenance it. So that Habakkuk is not saying that God can't see people sinning or can't stand to see people sinning, but rather that it's impossible for God to look favorably upon people sinning or to countenance it. So I don't really think it's, I don't think it's the teaching of Scripture that God can't bear to see sin. Otherwise, as you say, God would have to go on a long journey to the other end of the universe and not paying much attention to what's going on earth, because there's an awful lot of sinning going on. And the Bible says elsewhere that the eyes of the Lord are throughout the earth, beholding the evil and the good. It says that in Proverbs. It says that a number of places. So we know that God does see the evil and the good. We know that he doesn't countenance the evil. He doesn't approve of it. But he sees it. Now, certainly God is holy, and we often hear that a holy God hates sin, and I'm sure he does. But he doesn't hate it because he's thin-skinned. And this is something we have to understand. God's hatred for sin is not that he's just so touchy he can't stand to have someone defy him. He just can't stand to have someone say no when he says yes, or for them to say yes when he says no. Obviously, it's entirely inappropriate for a created being to respond to God that way and to not obey him. But it's not like God is so touchy, so peevish that, you know, he just gets bent out of shape when people do the wrong thing. God has been watching people sin for thousands of years, and he's still a gracious God. He's still a God in control of himself and of everything else. He's doing fine. He's doing fine. And frankly, even a large-hearted godly man can be in the presence of sin. Think of Jesus himself. Jesus hung out at times with people who were regarded to be sinners. In fact, there were people who were regarded more righteous, the Pharisees. Jesus didn't hang with them very, not deliberately. I mean, they had him over for dinner sometimes, but he usually took the occasion to rebuke them. But Jesus seemed to be at least as comfortable at a meal with tax collectors as at a meal with Pharisees. Because I think a person who is secure in who he is and in God, he can be in the presence of things he disapproves of, and yet not be just all bent out of shape about it. And I don't think that God is bent out of shape. Now, why does God hate sin then? What does it mean? I believe what he hates about sin is that sin is the cancer in the creation that God has made. God made a human race with whom he wished to have a wonderful relationship. And this cancer of sin entered in and has infected everybody, and everybody's dying of it. And he hates it, just like you would hate a cancer that was in your own child. You wouldn't hate your child, but you'd hate the cancer that was killing your child. And that's what God hates about sin, I think, is not that he just can't stand to have someone say, ignore him or treat him with disrespect. By the way, anyone who does ignore him or treat him with disrespect, they're going to have to answer for it, and it's not going to be a pretty thing. But it's not like God just is so immature or so thin-skinned that he just can't handle it. It's rather he hates sin because sin hurts the people he loves, and that's everybody. And so the reason God is intolerant of sin is not because he hates sinners. In fact, Jesus was specifically called a friend of sinners. And the Bible says God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him would not perish but have everlasting life. That world that he loved were sinners. And Jesus said God did not come in the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. So God, who hates sin, nonetheless is totally devoted to people. And all people are sinners, so he's devoted to people who are sinners too. But he hates the sin because it destroys them, and we can see it. We can see it destroying people's lives. And even people who later repent and come to Christ and die on good terms with God because of that, often you can look at how sin in their past has ruined their lives. I'm thinking of a particular person right now whose life is very much ruined health-wise and so forth, although that person has come to Christ and is serving God now in a wonderful way. But no wonder God hates sin. It damages people. Even the ones who come out of it often bear the scars from it for maybe the rest of their lives. And others who don't ever come out of it are damaged forever by it would appear, or at least on into time beyond the grave. So that's what I understand about God's hatred of sin. It doesn't mean he can't look at sin on the world, or else he'd have to be hiding his eyes an awful lot, like I have to do at some movies and things like that. But God's more mature than I am and more pure. In fact, his very purity means that he doesn't have the same kind of problems viewing sin that you and I would have, who are not as pure as he is. But that'd be, I guess, the best way I know to answer your question. And Jack, since you're not still on the line, I can't ask you if I really covered your question. I sometimes wonder when someone asks a question, then gets off the line, if I understood their question well enough to get it answered. But I hope so. Let's talk to Ann from Boring, Oregon. And if you want to be on the program, you might have time. The number is 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. Ann, thanks for waiting, and welcome to the Narrow Path.
Some of the questions and the way you answered them, I'm very thankful for. You answered some of mine. I have a question here. It might be multiple. There might not be time. And let me know. I can come back next week. I'm interested in Matthew chapter 24.
Yes.
And I would go to the third verse. It says, he set up on the Mount of Olives. His disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be? He's talking about the temple.
Yes.
And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? I've always taken it as there's three questions. they're asking. And when I read Matthew 24, I have a little trouble determining which question he's actually answering. And I
sure.
may not have enough background to know which is which.
Actually, it's a pretty well-informed question. I've always heard, well, I don't know always, but when I was younger, I always heard that the disciples asked three questions also. One, he had predicted the destruction of the temple, and they said, when shall these things be? There's, when will the temple be destroyed?
Right.
And then the next question is, what will be the sign of your coming, which I took to be the second coming at the end of the world? And then the end of the world, I took to be the end of the millennium, because I was premillennial, which I'm no longer. But so I saw three different questions there. Today, I see only two. and they're both. And both questions are about the same event. Jesus spoke of the destruction of the temple in the verses just previous to the question. And he spoke of nothing else. He spoke only of the destruction of the temple. He said not one stone would be left standing on another. And the disciples said, A, when shall these things be? In other words, when will the temple be destroyed? The second question, Matthew divides into two parts. And that might even be the way the disciples asked it. But Mark and Luke, in recording the same question, make it a simpler question. See, in Mark 13 and Luke 21, the same questions are asked, the same discourse is given. And if you look at the parallels in Mark 13 and Luke 21, the question, there's only two questions. And after Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple, the disciples say, first of all, when shall these things be? So that's the same as Matthew 24:3. When shall these things be? So when will the temple be destroyed? And then their other question is, and what sign shall there be that these things are about to take place? Now, both questions in Mark and Luke are about these things, the destruction of the temple. The first is, when will it be? And the second is, what sign will there be that is about to happen? So they want to know the general time period. And then they want to know if there's going to be anything to clue them in that it's imminent, that it's going to happen any moment. But interestingly, in Mark and Luke, the question is framed only about the destruction of the temple and no reference to anything beyond. Now, in Matthew, the second part of that question seems to be two-pronged. After they say, when shall these things be, which is parallel with Mark and Luke, Matthew has them saying, and what shall be the sign? Now, that also parallels Mark and Luke, but then it changes. Because in Mark and Luke, they say, what should be the sign that these things are about to happen? But in Matthew, it's phrased, what should be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Now, the King James Version says the end of the world. The word in the Greek is aeon, which means really age. And so my thought is, and I could be wrong, but I don't think I'm wrong. I think my thought is, that Matthew is giving us the actual wording Jesus used, and Mark and Luke are paraphrasing it to make it clear what they were really meaning. Because when they said, what should be the sign of your coming? I don't think they were thinking of the second coming. And you know why I don't? Because he had never told them about it, or at least they didn't know about it. They didn't know he was going away. And therefore, the concept of a second coming would have been entirely foreign to their thinking, because they didn't know until after he rose from the dead that he was even going to be gone and have to come back. So I think they use the word coming differently than we're thinking of it, because after his ascension, we always think of the coming of the Lord as, you know, him coming back from heaven, and he will. But they didn't have that concept at this point in their lives. And I think they were using the word coming in the same way that the Old Testament prophets used it, which was referring to simply a judgment from God, a judgment from Jesus upon his enemies. I think they understood him to be saying, this temple, because the Jews and its leaders are rejecting me, is going to be leveled to the ground. Not one stone to be left on another. And that is a judgment for their rejecting me. I think that's what they understood it mean. And your coming, I think they took to mean your coming in judgment against the temple. Not a literal second coming in this case, but rather the way the Old Testament prophets spoke of destructions from God were like God coming or God visiting. It's a figure of speech that the Jews used all the time in the Old Testament, and I think the disciples were using it too. And when they say the end of the age, I think they mean the Jewish age. The destruction of the temple was the end of an age, the age of the law, the age of the Old Covenant. It had started 1,400 years earlier in the time of Moses, and it came to an end in 70 A.D. And I think that was the end of an age. And when they said to him, when shall these things be? That is, when shall the temple be destroyed? What shall be the sign of your coming? I think by coming, they mean they understand him to be coming in judgment, not a second coming, but rather figuratively a coming of judgment from God upon Jerusalem. And the end of the age, well, the destruction of the temple would be the end of the Jewish age. So when I think Matthew records it exactly as the disciples said it. And I think Mark and Luke paraphrase it, that second part of the question, because of its ambiguity. Mark and Luke simply record it as, when shall these things be and what shall be the sign that these things are about to take place? So if we use Mark and Luke to cross-reference with Matthew 24:3, it would appear that they're really only asking two questions about the same thing. Jerusalem's going to be destroyed. When will it be? And what sign will God give to let his disciples know that it's coming soon so they can prepare themselves? And if that is the case, then Jesus' answer was quite suited to the questions, because he said in Matthew 24:34, this generation will not pass before these things. Right. And that would be the answer to the first question. When will this be?
Right.
Well, in this generation it'll be. And the second question, what sign will there be? He gave them the answer to that in verse 15, where he said, when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it is not, then know that this is the time. And in Luke's version, Luke 21:20, instead of saying the abomination of desolation, Luke paraphrases it this way. He says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. So the abomination of desolation, as it's worded in Matthew and Mark, is paraphrased in Luke as Jerusalem surrounded by armies. So they asked, will there be a sign that this is about to happen? He says, yeah, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then you know it's about to happen. Its desolation is near. Then he said, flee. He said, get out of Jerusalem. Go across the river. So
right.
he did answer both their questions.
Exactly. But I think you helped me a lot. But it says down here, but heaven and earth shall pass away. But if that day and hour knoweth no man.
Yes, good point. And I think when he says in verse, is it 35, where he says heaven and earth shall pass away? I'm not looking at it right now. But
right, and then 36, and then it's
okay.
37,
right.
The days of Noah.
I'll tell you what I think. Not a lot of people disagree with me about this, but I believe that when Jesus says, this generation shall not pass before all these things are fulfilled, he's summarizing everything that he said before. That's about 70 A.D. And then he says, heaven and earth will pass away. Now, that hasn't happened yet. And he says, of that day and hour, no one knows. And then he starts talking. At that point, I believe he's talking about the end of the world there, when heaven and earth will pass away. And that would be the second coming.
That's what I thought. I had, let's see, another question in regard to this.
I would love to take it, but you have to call next week because the whistling has begun.
That's what I'm thinking, Steve, because I'm not a millennialist either. And
We can talk about this if you want to call back Monday. Right now, I'm going to be forced off the air in just less than a minute.
Well, thank you for your answers, and I will be happy to call back. Thank you.
Oh, okay, and thank you for your call. God bless you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And there's also another program now on Sunday nights called The Road to Find Out, which is directed toward a non-believing audience. That's on a different station. That's actually on KSCO 1080 AM in the Santa Cruz area. But you can hear both programs on the Internet, and you'll want to go to our website to check that out. The website is thenarrowpath.com, thenarrowpath.com. By the way, Orange County and thereabouts, listeners, I'll be in Orange County tomorrow at 4 o'clock at our meeting there in a home. If you want to go there, there's contact information at the website. The website, again, thenarrowpath.com. Click the announcements link. If you want to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path at P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Thanks for joining us. I hope you have a great weekend. Tune in again Monday, and we will continue our discussion. God bless you.